Hi, and welcome to Five Compelling Questions with Sean. This is the podcast where we get to know writers through a series of questions about writing and craft and experiences and, I don't know, things we like to eat, whatever comes to mind. And it's really not ever five questions, as you know, if you've been listening for any amount of time to this podcast. I'm very happy today to have my guest, Mark Licklider. And we just had a conversation about how to say that name because it doesn't look like Licklider. It looks like Leichleiter or Leichleiter.
And if we were in Germany, Sean, that would probably be the way to be pronounced.
Okay, so I'm just being authentic by accident. You're being
authentic. That's right. Preparing for European travel is what you're doing.
Right. Accidentally authentic. That's from the name of my next podcast. So just a brief introduction of you, Mark. First of all, thanks for coming.
Well, thank you for hosting. And thanks for all the hard work on the book.
Oh, well, you're welcome. It's a great book. The Other Side. It's not your debut novel, but it just came out recently, right? Last couple of weeks.
Yeah, on June 8th it came out. So yeah, and it's a debut for crime fiction for me. So
awesome.
New world, new genre, new fun.
Yeah, new editors.
New editors.
New processes. So I will just do a brief intro. Mark Licklider also writes as Mark Hummel, which is another whole other conversation. We were just talking about hiding and witness protection if we needed to. We have so many last names. Mark is the author of the contemporary literary novel In the Chameleon's Shadow and the short story collection Lost and Found. His fiction, poetry, and essays have regularly appeared in a variety of literary journals, including such publications as the Bloomsbury Review, Dogwood, Fugue. I always love that word because I can say it. There are many words I can't say, but luckily Fugue is not one of them. Talking River Review, and Weber, The Contemporary West, and Zone 3. So those are all, I'm sure, searchable under Mark Hummel or Licklider. A former college professor and writing program director, Mark has also served as a teacher in an independent high school, directed a writer's conference, worked as a librarian, and taught on the faculty of several writer's conferences. He is the founding editor of the nonfiction magazine Bio Stories. He lives in Wyoming, in Montana's Flathead Valley, which sort of ties in with The Other Side, right? Tell us a little bit about The Other Side and the setting and the premise.
Yeah, it's set in Northwest Montana. So I'm a Wyoming native. We moved to Montana 7 years ago. We live in a little town called Big Fork, which is on the shores of Flathead Lake. And Flathead Lake is the largest freshwater lake west of the Mississippi. So it and Tahoe are pretty close in size. So it's this immense, enormous lake, very deep, and you know, beautiful, beautiful country. And yeah, the book is set here, and it actually features a fictionalized detective in a real organization, which is the Flathead County Sheriff's Department. And the events of the book start with the disappearance of a 17-year-old in another little kind of tourist town on the other side of the lake from where I live, in Lakeside, Montana. So I've been in the Intermountain West virtually the whole of my life, up and down Colorado, Wyoming. We lived for a lot of years in Jackson Hole. Came here, and a lot of this book kind of came out of being in environments that felt familiar, but a little bit different, lower elevation, a little lean towards the Pacific Northwest, and quite different weather because we're cloudy and rainy and here a good part of the year. And so like a lot of crime fiction writers, I spent undue time walking backwoods trails thinking, it'd be really easy to hide a body here. There are no cameras around. A lot of the book kind of came out of the finicky weather here. You know, yesterday was a great example where it was sunny, picture bluebird, Montana skies, highs in the 70s, and then at 6 p.m. we had a massive rainstorm move through that was knocked over trees and dropped about an inch of rain and then was gone in 15 minutes. So, place of constant change. And that's kind of the flavor of the book too, is it's a region that's changing. It's changed even more radically. And here in 2020, last year with COVID, you know, it's a really desirable place to live. So people that can work remotely or people are reaching retirement more and more flooding in from the coast. And so it's a place kind of trying to figure out its own growing pains, you know, mm-hmm. with a lot of new faces and a lot of inflation and home prices and that kind of thing. And that's a theme that's kind of recurrent throughout the book is how new and old fit together. It's a place where you have like little ramshackle fishing cabins that have been around for 100 years next to a $4 million mansion, you know, both on the lake. Yeah.
That's cool. Yeah. I was thinking, I've been talking to a few people about, you know, now that we're sort of emerging from what we've all just been through, you know, with a pandemic, like it's different everywhere, but you know, we were just told yesterday by July 1st, most of the mandates are going to be gone. So what is going to be on the other side of that is going to be different for every area, you know, just people getting back to work, people deciding they don't want to live in the city anymore, stuff like that.
Well, that's exactly what we're seeing. We're about an hour from Glacier National Park. You know, we're completely surrounded by giant, beautiful forests and such. It's a very, you know, artsy, interesting, like this community I live in is really kind of founded by a lot of artists after, you know, the timber industry left. And, you know, it's intriguing as people now are starting to make different choices with their lives, right? And those that have the financial capability to have those freedoms are saying, well, maybe I don't want to live in the city anymore. Or maybe I want to raise my kids somewhere else.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
it's gonna, you know, when anything that major happens, there's always, it's gonna be a ripple effect for a lot of people, you know, for a long time to come, you know.
Yeah.
We've learned from it, as well as, you know, we suffered through things, but we've also learned from it, like maybe we could be more efficient, you know, maybe we could be nicer to the environment, but not everyone getting on the road every morning at the same time, or, you know. So I like to think of the positive benefits of.
Exactly. I think there are some very real ones. Including a chance to talk to you right now.
If I were in charge of everything, everything would be great. But I'm only in charge of most of things, not everything. So, just kidding. Okay. First of the official questions. When did you first realize that words have power, that something you wrote had an impact on someone or a situation you were in?
Well, one of the interesting things that's happened in the week since the book launched, through, you know, the unpredictability of social media, as a friend of a friend or something reached out to make a nice comment about the book and congratulate me and such. And eventually it trickled down to one of her friends who turned out to be my 7th grade English teacher. So shout out to Mrs. Garcia. She was an absolutely amazing, amazing teacher. And I was a pretty serious, studious kid that didn't have a lot of confidence. And she took me under her wing. And one of the things she did is in addition to English, she taught a film studies course. And she let a bunch of 7th graders submit scripts and then eventually make a movie. And I wrote a script called The 6 Cent Man. So this dates me because it was a play on The $6 Million Man. So I was already interested in satire and sarcasm then. And the class got to vote on the finalist, and they chose instead a script called The Amazing Hamburglar. And Mrs. Garcia came to me and she said, "Mark, you know, I'm disappointed because honestly, yours was the better script." And then she just went on to support me and through 3 years and follow me and kind of, I you know, in some ways I credit, you know, that one reader, right, being willing to say this is good. And so my payoff, since I didn't get the script done, was I got to direct the other movie, which was its own bunch of fun. But I do think it was one of those moments, because I've been, you know, as a kid writing stories since I could practically hold a pen. And it was definitely one of those moments where, oh, wait a minute, this, you know, somebody reacted to this. This touched somebody. This, you know, she thought this was good. So that's certainly an earliest moment that I would catch as one where you realize kind of the power of the pen.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's fun how a lot of writers are really into movies too, and I always have been. I'm a huge movie buff, fanatic, whatever. I have you know, because I'm the way, because it's me. I made a giant spreadsheet of all the movies that have been nominated for Academy Awards since 1970 through today, and I make sure I see them all because I didn't go to film school, so that's my film school for myself. But then I realized it's because it's stories. It's like a good story. Storytelling is what we're really passionate about, whatever form it takes. So
yeah, absolutely. And I think part of my, to move genres and to move into crime fiction, it's something that had been kind of growing in me for quite a while, but I think film helped do that for me as well. And then film kind of got me back to reading a whole lot of books that I might not have encountered otherwise. And I think, crime fiction is particularly adept at that movement to serialize film or to serialize, Netflix, or whatever the case is, where you can tell those long stories. And I know for both my wife and I that, that's kind of our favorite film genre. So, it became another learning place, I think, for me too, for the writing. Yeah,
and mine too, for sure. I've always loved crime movies ever since I was a kid. My mom would always put on the black and white, channel. We'd watch old, Humphrey Bogart movies and stuff. And they're all about solving a mystery, solving a crime. And then, of course, graduated to, those are my favorites. My sister loves rom-coms, so we watch those with her. But most of the time, I want to see someone getting killed and then someone figuring it out. That's what I like. Just kill somebody and figure it out. Move on from there. So, all right, next question. How do you develop the voices of your characters? Do you keep a Bible or use some other methods to bring your characters to life? And this is a good question for you because your characters are very well-developed and interesting. So this will be interesting for me to hear.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. That's important for me to hear because it is an absolute critical aspect of how I want to approach this book and all books. This book is, I think it has a really captivating plot, and the early reviews comment a lot about, very unpredictable twists and turns, and like the fact that it keeps the reader guessing. And I hope those things are true. But its heart for me remains characters, and both with the protagonist that's leading the investigation. And for me, this book was extremely important. My own life's been touched by crime several times in some really horrific ways, including having a cousin murdered when I was in my late teenage years and such. And some other tragedies that happened close to home and close to the family and such. And so that's, for me, always a reminder that I want to be careful and do right by those that are victims of crime as well, and be authentic to them, and really try to present them in their full psychology and their full emotion. I think there's a bit of a risk, particularly I'm trying to write very realistic crime fiction that's well-researched and careful. And I think there's a risk if you take that tack towards crime fiction, that if you can't honor your characters in their full dimensionality, it feels unfair to me. It feels like it creates an acceptable level of violence in a society that's already too violent. So that's very important to me. As far as trying to get to them, I think the critical thing for me is that I had an old writing teacher that said writers are, she was from Oklahoma, so she loved oil metaphors. So she said writers are ekers or gushers. And I'm definitely an eker. It ekes out. But I also am one that I love the unknown. I love the mystery of writing. I love the joy of discovering things I didn't know were going to happen. And that's important to me in regards to character, too. So I try to reach a place like Alice Walker talked about in that famous piece she did, that nonfiction piece where she talks about, I think she signs it as Alice Walker, author and savant or something like that. But this notion that if you clear enough space, you can listen to your characters, you can hear them speak, you can hear what their lives are. For me, if I ever find myself dictating things for my characters to do, I don't trust the book at all. Mm-hmm. When they start to tell me their story, then I trust the book. And that's what happened with this book, is that those characters became quite real to me. And so I really try to go in open to anything, open to the story where it takes me, open to the character. I think a lot of the plot for this book comes naturally from the characters' lines mm-hmm. and their demeanors. And I just find tremendous joy in approaching writing that way. And I, whether it's trying to write dialogue or trying to get into the inner lives of characters, I credit things like, you know, I put myself through college working night shifts at the grocery store, and I was assigned the dairy section a lot of the time. So I would go in the dairy and I'd open all the back doors behind the milk and the butter and all of that. So they were all open and I could hear the voices passing down the aisles, or I could see glimpses of faces and that kind of thing. And that kind of intensive listening, you know, to listening to how people speak, listening to how they carry conversations with each other, listening to what they reveal to one another when they don't know anyone's paying attention. Mm-hmm. So that purposeful kind of observation and eavesdropping, to me, that's a training ground for character development too.
Absolutely, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I did, I put myself through school working in a restaurant and also in an office in DC. So I would go take full load of classes and go to the office for the afternoon, close up the office, go to the bar, work it until 2 a.m. I don't know how I did it because I'm tired just thinking about it, but you don't think about being tired when you're 20, you know, you're like, whatever.
Right.
But people, and then I started working, you know, from there being a catering person, and especially working around a lot of really wealthy people, different, they don't see you anymore because you're just like the person, they're all dressed the same. We're in their, you know, we're in their little uniforms where, you know, bringing you food and drinks and stuff. And you become part of the furniture at some point. And they just talk about their business. They talk about every single thing. You're like, I don't know. Shouldn't be talking about your marriage right in front of me. I'm standing right here. That's, you know, geez. But being a bartender is like that too. You hear everything, and people don't realize when you're standing behind the bar, you hear all of it. You hear every conversation's coming right at you. I've seen people break up. I've seen people get engaged. I've seen it all. And it's great. Cause it's the training ground for realistic people and how people act and how they shouldn't be acting and how they should be.
Right, how they shouldn't be acting.
Oh, I've seen that happen. Why would they do that? But yeah, it's good to be like that anonymous person in the background listening. And it's just, you're not trying to eavesdrop. It's just they're sharing their stuff out in front of you, you know?
Exactly.
In later years, as a more mature person, you go sit in a coffee shop, and I like to write in coffee shops once in a while just to have a change of scenery because I'm always at my desk. And people come into coffee shops and talk about stuff that I would think they'd want to have that conversation.
All the time.
You should be in your therapist's office or at home, not here at the talking about this stuff to everyone. But yeah, it's really fascinating what people will divulge.
It is. I do the same thing. And I used to do that as an assignment with writing students too. I'd say, okay, go, you know, place yourself in a tall booth where you can't be seen.
Oh, that's so cool.
Watch, listen, you know, start by actually writing down an actual conversation that somebody's having, and then just continue it.
That's cool. Absence,
you know, and that kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great writing prompt. Ooh, that's a good idea. I may have to steal that one. I'll have to steal that. I'll borrow it from you. Give it back.
There you go.
All right. Next question. Sure. Has anything you've written surprised you? I think we already started talking about this a little bit. In other words, you had no idea something was going to happen and it showed up on the page. So you said your characters start speaking to you. So I assume they've told you something very surprising.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I'm religious about this, Sean, and it's to a fault. So my revision process is pretty different than others because I don't have a clue what I'm writing at the time. And I know I'm not alone on that one, but I have writer friends that, you know, we just approach differently. We think differently and they, you know, plan an outline and that's what works. That's what produces text for them. For me, can kill text. I have a failed book that's been through a dozen revisions and I still just don't like it. And I think it's a failed book because I was writing it from an original source. So I was kind of constrained by the actual story behind it. And there were elements handed to me and I just don't think I work that way. Yeah. So for me, almost everything's a surprise. So I'm the idiot who chose to write a crime novel that eventually leads to from a disappearance to a what appears to be a probable death, and I had no idea who might be responsible for it. for a long, 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 long time. And actually, that was some of the tremendous fun of writing this is just really starting to see, you know, what's the real probability here, and what are the possibilities, and what's the text telling me, and what's the, you know, for me, it's even back to what we were talking about with Montana. It's what is the place support? What's the nature? What's the rhythm of this place, and what does it support? And what's the rhythm of this moment that we're living in? I view this as a very obviously not contemporary to 2021, but you know, within a handful of years of this moment. So what's the place support in this age? Mm-hmm. What are the natural characters that emerge from that? And so for me, then it's just that openness again. So quite seriously, there are lots of surprises, and in this case, a pretty key one. I'll leave that as a tease for readers. Yeah. that I didn't see coming. So that was fun.
Absolutely. Well, that's fun. And I work the same way. So I get exactly what you're saying, because I don't outline, and I've tried it, and I immediately deviate from the outline. It's almost like I've wasted all that time doing that.
Yeah.
So I just don't, and then you're frustrated, and then you just feel like it's already like, why am I creating this? No one told me to do this, and I feel like I'm failing at something. So I just sit down and write, and then I think, as you were saying, you don't know who the culprit is until the end, but it's almost like you're working with the detective to figure it out in a way.
Right.
You're working with the character to like, okay, who could have done this? You know, it's like, right. And I'm walking around doing, then I always figure it out when I'm doing dishes or laundry or something else.
Like, absolutely.
Oh, that person could have done it. And then you just have to go back through, sort of make sure it threads together. But that's my process as well. I just don't, I guess I'm just not, I'm a free spirit person. I don't deal well with a lot of, I never was cut out for like an office job. So I was always a salesperson, because I would check in the office in the morning and then I'd be on my way. And I always did marketing I was out on the road, you know, all out in the struggle, worked in Manhattan. So I was walking around, but I never had to be inside. I don't feel happy if I'm constrained.
I'm absolutely the same way.
Yes. Yeah. I rail against deadlines. I always try to push.
Yeah, I don't do well with rules.
this seems like you're trying to tell me what to do. That's why I work for, you know, I've always tried to work for myself, and you know, things go, but everyone's different.
Yeah, everyone's different. And I think that's important to recognize, is that every writer has different needs and different approaches that work for them. I think for younger writers or writers that are less experienced, it's about finding, you know, what is your own process? What works for your process? Because that's the only thing you can really be true to in the end.
Yeah. I also studied music, and I was going to be a musician at one point in my life. So, but it's similar to, I railed against practicing too. but I could get up there and play perfectly. So that was just, it's just the way I think everyone is built differently as far as what their personality responds to. And, you know, it's like when you've been a teacher, it's like in school, everyone learns differently. And I think when I was younger, it was sort of like the cookie cutter. You have to show up and do these things and then you learn. And it's like they're so smart about teaching kids in different ways. And because we respond to stimulus differently, and we respond to everything differently. So I love that we've made some advances, you know. I'm always like, well, why didn't they know that when I was in school? Why are they?
Exactly.
I shouldn't have to write this thing over 100 times to learn it. That's dumb, you know.
Right.
That's what the Catholic schools do for you. They let you they make you sit and write a bunch of stuff 100 times. So anyway, and it turns you into a rebellious hippie like me. That's what you get.
I think the world's better for it. Yeah. Some more rebellious.
Yeah. Too many rules too early for me. Okay. What were some challenges you faced while writing this book? And don't say it was your editor. You can say that if you want to.
It definitely wasn't that.
Okay.
Well, I mean, it, in a way, it's an extension of what we've been talking about. So a couple levels of challenge. One is because I'm a free spirit, as you are, in the approach to writing, it does change the nature of the revision process, because a lot of revision then becomes figuring out where things fit, figuring out, you know, what's the more logical flow, moving chapters around. I'm a great believer that the best books, you know, start as close to the end as they can get. Mm-hmm. And so that sometimes like in this book, it literally meant moving some early chapters around and just reorganizing their structure and withholding some things for longer and then breaking chapters up where I'd simply gone too long in, you know, the development of Steve Wendell, who's the lead detective in this book, that kind of thing. For me, the other challenge, as you're probably guessing right now, is going over long and writing too much length and then having to figure out to shrink this and let go of, you know, those little darlings you don't want to let go of. And this book was at one point, I think, a solid at least 20,000 words longer than it is in its final form. And that's, you know, it's a challenging process, but at the same time, it's a super rewarding one, and it's a really instructive one. Your editing made it a better book, absolutely, and Harriet's editing did as well. And Harriet pointed out patterns for me of things that were those, oh yeah, I should have known better with great regularity, that you think you've learned in your career and you still commit the same problems all the time. And you start to see, you know, what's needed and what's not. One of my go-to readers is a friend that's just, you know, one of those tremendously insightful and painfully honest readers who you need to read early versions of a book. And she has a phrase that sticks in my head all the time, which when she talks to me about, we used to kayak rivers together. And so she, now when she's talking about early versions of manuscripts with me, when she's reading for me, one of the things she says is, Mark, stay in the boat, which is just a shorthand, you know, of keeping in mind what matters, what's needed, what keeps the reader moving forward, and what you should let go of, and when you've got her out of the boat. And so there was a lot of the echo in my head from my friend Susan saying, stay in the boat, Mark, as I did the editing. So that was a challenge. I think the third thing I would say is the challenge here was came out of another thing that we've talked about, and I was just trying to get things right, you know, trying to be accurate and authentic and honest, and learn some of the inside of police culture. I kind of grew up around a lot of law enforcement culture and all my friends' fathers, and so I had some insights from that side from early ages. But you know, there was an important consultant that I found that I reached out to that's was in this actual Flathead County Sheriff's Department as a detective that, you know, just knew a lot about their own procedures as well as interviewing techniques and that kind of thing. So, you know, that learning curve of trying to honor those people who do actual investigations and portray them with some accuracy and some heart and all of that.
I think you did a good job there. Like I said, I really love your book. So everyone needs to go buy The Other Side right now, download it, read it today. Or, I mean, it's available at all your favorite bookstores. Yeah, as well.
This book right here.
Yeah, that pretty book. Fifth question. This is my choice. I get to choose. If you could invite one famous writer to dinner, who would it be and why?
You don't really get one?
Yeah, you mentioned Alice Walker. So now you have to talk with you. Oh, man.
Okay, so this was one of those answers that would change every day. Yes. So if you call me every day this week, we'll have another answer. Yeah. Boy. So someone I would really, really just love to hang out with because she just seems so damn cool would be Zora Neale Hurston. You know, this wonderful Harlem Renaissance Black writer who was so far ahead of her time. So sassy and wonderful, who, you know, she captured both the rural and the urban just brilliantly well. She wrote just so authentically from the point of view of women. You know, she was able to capture something about the experience of being Black in America in the 20s and 30s. And, you know, she was an anthropologist by training. And so she had that eye and understanding kind of, you know, how cultures worked and how people interacted. And she understood the nature of the complexities, I think, of race in America. in a way that, that most people never quite get to. And yet she did so without ever feeling quite bitter. And she certainly was able to convey, you know, African-American stories that people had never heard. And I don't know, I love that era of the 20s. So I just picture Zora with a crazy hat and, you know, showing up at dinner. I can only imagine the fun conversations that might emerge. And, you know, she struck me, and if you've read any of her books, and she told it like it was, she didn't hold back. And I don't think there was ever any meanness in that. It was just truth, you know, and I have tremendous respect for that. So today's choice is Zora. Well, might be another favorite.
Well, you spoke about it so eloquently, it seems like you have that answer ready, but you didn't, because I surprised you with it. So well done you. Excuse me, here I'm coughing. Okay, so the final quiz is five rapid fire questions. You can answer them any way you like. All the answers are correct or incorrect or however you want to view it. So hold on 1 second. We'll pause. And now for the rapid final quiz that for some reason I came up with this, and I'm not sure why we stuck with it, but it's kind of fun. And you I've surprised myself by hearing some really controversial answers from these.
Okay.
Okay. Number one, beach or mountains?
Mountain.
Okay. That's not surprising.
Yeah.
You live on a mountain peak, right? In Montana. I'm kidding.
Almost.
picture all the states out there, like, you know, people just like walking around on top of mountains, because
that's what we do.
Or fishing, like those big salmon that jump out and like curl around. That's
we're like the Swiss, you know, you have sheep that follow you around and you have a backpack on all the time.
Yeah, because I'm a city person, and that's how we all think of, that's how we think of people out there. Cake or pie?
Cake. Chocolate, preferably.
Me too. Ooh, I love chocolate. Morning person or night owl?
Oh, I'm both. That's the problem. I'm more night owl, but because I try to make a living as a writer, I have to get up really early and get my writing day started immediately. So I cherish my mornings, but I do try to burn it at both ends, which is a recipe for disaster, but yeah, you just don't sleep well.
I'm the same way. I do the same thing. And I'm so mad at myself on both ends of the day, because I just want to watch one more episode and have one more, you know, vodka tonic, and then I'll go to bed and I'll get up and I'll be fine. And I'm like,
exactly.
Well,
I think honestly, those writers are, at least I am, I'm always chasing quiet too. Right. Yeah. So I do sometimes, as you do, right, in coffee shops, mostly I kind of need dead silence. And so
yeah,
got to chase that both ends of the day.
Yeah, because my life is chaos otherwise, except for from 5 a.m. to about not 8 or late at night, but then I'm too tired. And I don't break, my brain kind of shuts off. I just have to watch, I have to zone out to some TV shows. I can't create at that hour because I'll make mistakes. So I'm too tired. Dogs or cats?
Dogs, 100%.
Cool.
I like to make fun of cats, but
I think they probably like to make fun of you too.
Probably.
I think cats.
We cat and dog sat for neighbors last weekend, and we'd had cats earlier in my life, but been a long time. Mm-hmm. So it took the cat 3 days to accept me. I'm very proud of that acceptance.
Cats are, I think they're just secretly like trying to find ways to kill us when we're not looking. I like cats too, but they are more, dogs are more like, hey, what's going on?
But, you know? But if you put it on a different scale and you compare the Dog Diary series to the Cat Diary series, cats went out on that one.
That's
and
true.
If you don't know what I'm talking about, you need to YouTube it, because it'll be good for a long laugh.
Oh, okay. I'll check it out. that's a tip for everyone listening. Oh, okay. And finally, coffee or tea?
Tea.
Oh, really? I would have picked coffee for you.
No, I can't stand the taste of it.
Really?
I'm married to someone that's addicted to it. She just, you know, puts it straight into the vein and hooks it up. Now she had to give it up about a year and a half ago. I thought we might lose her to the insane asylum there for a bit, but she's adjusted.
Wow.
So now I'm into the foo-foo teas, Sean. You know, so I mail away to Seattle for, you know, tea.
Oh. Fancy. Yeah. Marina is a giant tea lover as well. So I'm always finding tea gifts for her because she likes all the fancy teas and everything. She doesn't do coffee.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, tea is cool. I like tea in the afternoon. I like tea in the wintertime in the afternoons. But I'm a coffee.
I'm a little addicted to chai. So, you know, there's that. And oat milk.
Yeah. Tea's come a long way since
English. It has come a long way.
She used to be like, here's your, you know, Lipton's, whatever. And that's all exactly. We have. So what's going on with you now? What's next? What can we look forward to?
I've got two books going. So I'm in the research stages on a follow-up to this book that's going to really focus on a huge problem nationwide, but particularly prevalent in Western states, which is the disappearance of Indigenous women. And I've found a couple of sources that are kind of giving me some entrance points to a reservation that's just south of where I live here, a Salish woman that's actually done a lot of research on this topic. But I've got a really intriguing twist I want to play with and kind of get into a little bit of, you know, the international aspects of human trafficking. So that's in the research stages, and I'm about 60 pages into a new historical / literary novel. It's roughly based on the life of an actual person, a woman who at 40 kind of walked away from what some might say was a very predictable and maybe even empty life and chose a totally different path, and within a few years ended up working for the State Department, and she spent her whole career in crazy hot spots. She was in Sri Lanka, she was in Afghanistan, and where the book starts is 1966 in Vietnam, in the heart of the American presence in the Vietnam War, with her working in the embassy there. And maybe getting the eye of people who think she could you know, become useful in other ways. So I'll leave it at that as a little bit of a teaser
too. Cool. Well, those both sound very intriguing.
Yeah.
That's exciting. It's always good to have projects to go, you know, to keep be working on. Always have something going that you're striving for as a writer. Absolutely. Keeps you fresh, keeps you nimble.
That's right.
Well, it's been so fun talking to you. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Well, thank you, Sean. And thanks to Level Best and Harriet and the whole gang. Couldn't be happier to be able to share this book and get it out in the world. Couldn't have happened without you.
Well, we're exceedingly proud of you and it, and it's a wonderful book, and wishing you all the success, which you're already, you know, having, which is great.
Thank you. So,
all right, well, hopefully you'll come back on again soon, and we'll talk to you later.
All right, thanks, Sean.
Thanks.